I don't have a good voice. Everybody knows that. So, it's just, you know, there are two things to think of. One is anything that is popular, anything that is really popular, is often not really good. You know, so the fact that my work is popular does not necessarily mean that it's good. It just means that it's popular. The other thing is that whether it's written on a page or sung as a song, whether it's me or someone else that is singing, if you are in touch with that thing that moves a song from lip to lip, and you don't never command it, it's just if it's on you. I'm not just interested in going from city to city to gather the applause of the people. It's only nourishing to me if I can do something to them. I mean, you don't want to go in front of people unless you feel that you can give them something, and you can return to them the love that they feel to you through your song. And when you feel that, and when you don't feel that you can make it, it's a terrible feeling. You feel that you're cheating people, and I felt at the beginning that I was cheating people because I couldn't deliver the same emotion that they were giving me.
It's 1972. Leonard Cohen is three albums into his recording career. Amidst rumors that his record company is about to drop him, and toying with the idea of retiring from public performing, he embarks on a 20-day tour of Europe, culminating in a show in Jerusalem. English documentary filmmaker Tony Palmer follows the tour, witnessing the highs and lows of life on the road as Cohen mesmerizes his audiences. The resulting film, Bird on a Wire, reveals Cohen to be a man of humility and humor, taking in his stride for the most part everything from ongoing issues with the sound equipment to a riot at the Tel Aviv concert. We see that he's primarily interested in making a real connection with his audience, that he wants to be with them and to give them something of substance, something real. Today is November 27th, 2016. On the 10th, it was announced that we had lost Leonard, one of the great singer-songwriters of our time. I caught up with Tony Palmer to talk about the film he made with Leonard, a film which, after a few brief screenings in 1974, mysteriously disappeared and was thought to be lost for nearly four decades. A film that has, as Tony puts it, a complicated history.
I think importance is the wrong word, but I mean, I think the significance of the film is that when it was originally made in 1972, Leonard really was at the height of his powers as far as a stage performer and vocalist was concerned. So you hear in the film a man who really could sing. I mean, he always said, I have a terrible voice, I don't know why people ever want to hear me singing. But I thought at that time in his life, early 70s, he did sing idiosyncratically, but really beautifully. I had an interesting experience when the film was finished, because he was Canadian. The world public premiere, as it were, had to be in Canada. And although Leonard came from Montreal, it was decided to hold it in Toronto, partly because the Toronto Film Festival, and they have wonderful cinemas and wonderful projection and so on and so on. So I said, absolutely fine, delighted. Will you come and introduce it? Yes, I will come and introduce it. So just a few days before I set off, a call came. The thing is not only sold out, but they're queuing around the block. Could we have a second screening? I said, sure. So now I arrive. I introduce the film, and about 800-900 people in the packed cinema. It seemed to go quite well. Turn up the second night to introduce it. And I'm loitering in the foyer of the cinema, and this woman, a very nice, very attractive woman, came over and jabbed me in the ribs. She said, young man, I like that, young man, she said, you've ruined my love of Leonard Cohen. I said, what? She said, "You've ruined my love of Leonard Cohen." I said, "I'm really sorry. Not my intention. What happened?" And I said, "By the way, did you see the film last night?" "Oh yes, I saw the film last night." I said, "Well, what's wrong?" She said, "Well, those performances of Marianne and Suzanne and the board and so on, they're so emotional, they're so powerful. I went home afterwards and I got out the CDs, or the LPs, I don't know which, and I played the original record. They're terrible," she said. "What am I going to do?" I said, "Sweetheart, buy a copy. I'll give you a copy of the film, then you'll have it." So that was, in a way, proof of what I'm saying. And I think that partly had to do with the fact that he, in 1972, he told his manager, as he says several times in the film, "I never want to tour again. I'm a poet. I don't like this sort of business of appearing on stage, and I'm like a puppet." A broken down nightingale, I think he says at one point.
Again and again.
Again and again, yes. And he didn't like it. First thing he ever said to me was, "You know, I don't want to make this film." I said, "Yes, I've heard." And what he didn't know, I think he knew by the time we started touring, of the time the tour started, but he didn't know when he was really strong-armed into having the film made by his manager, a remarkable man called Marty Machat, that the record company had cancelled his contract or had not renewed it. So, at that time, 1972, if you had no record contract and you wouldn't tour, you know, from a commercial point of view, you were dead, effectively. I think Leonard knew that the record company, when we were on tour, weren't going to renew. He knew that this was his last ever tour, so he gave it everything. And of course, then there were all kinds of what might have been for others insurmountable problems. You know, the sound system didn't work. You know, the way various concerts had been set up was not terribly good, and so on and so on.
Why do you think he was against making the film?
He said, "You know, what I don't want is a tour film about a tour." You know, but more importantly, from his point of view, he didn't want to be portrayed as a singer of sentimental little love songs for Marianne or Suzanne or whatever girlfriend, as in Chelsea Hotel, that, you know, he was having an affair with at the time. That would diminish him, because he felt that his poetry, and therefore his songs, which came later, of course, had a very hard, quite specific, classically political with a small p edge. You know, they were about something. They were about the world in which we lived and the extent to which we were ruining this or ruining that, whether the environment or so on and so on. So, you know, he wanted to be absolutely sure that the political aspect of things was loud and clear. Now, it so happened that quite by chance, I knew when they flew me over to New York, where the meeting took place, I knew that something was going to be discussed, and in the back of my mind, I thought it might be a film. But I wasn't confident that it would come to pass, because I knew other people who tried to make films about Leonard and always been refused. And so I'd taken with me one of his books of poetry, Energy of Slaves, and I thought, at the very least, I'm going to get him to sign it for me. So I'm clutching this copy rather ostentatiously of Energy of Slaves, and of course he saw it, and he said, "Oh, so you know I'm a poet." I said, "Leonard, you know, that's how I first came about across you. I knew you were a poet. And it's only later I realized that you also sang. I'm sorry if it sounds a bit..." "No, no," he said, "that's fine." So that was what his concerns were. I mean, he was curiously not averse to publicity, but he was nervous of it, because he thought it would automatically portray him in not the light in which he wished to be portrayed, if you see what I mean, which was a serious poet about serious issues.
It's interesting that he would shy away from publicity like that, or from, you know, being well known, when at the same time he's obviously seeking to be well known and to be heard.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a contradiction.
Well, I mean, again, he says quite early on in the film, you know, what is success? You know, if I'm now, my poems, when they were published, you know, such as Energy of Slaves, you know, if they sold 5,000 copies, you know, I'd be very lucky. And now, he said, they sold 50,000 copies. But, you know, that's 20 years later, almost, or 15 years later. And, you know, if you win the Nobel Prize overnight, then that you can call a success. But not, you know, some poems I wrote when I was a teenager have suddenly now become mainstream thought. I mean, that he has in common with all great poets. I mean, that's no accident. You know, that is not success, that's survival. You know, these works have survived. And he, you know, he frequently said to me that, you know, he's amazed that he has survived and these poems has survived and the songs have survived. And therefore, you know, maybe they're not too bad after all. And that's not false modesty. That's just a realistic assessment of, you know, if you, I mean, Ted Hughes was the same. Ted Hughes, I knew quite well. I mean, at the end of his life, when he published Birthday Letters, which was his last published book, you know, it sold 100,000 copies. A poet selling 100,000 copies? You know, if you'd said that to Ted when Crow came out and maybe sold 5,000 copies, even when people said, my God, this is a great poet, go buy this stuff. You know, Fabers would never have expected to have sold as many as that. I don't know. They probably printed 500 copies to start with. What? They want a reprint? What's going on here? But, I mean, that's a long journey from that to 100,000 plus copies of Birthday Letters.
I guess that the length of time that the work is appreciated, or, you know, how many years have gone by since he originally wrote the work. I mean, I guess that gives you an indication that he is succeeding now.
Yes, he is. But it's his point again, or you, if you're going back to talking about Leonard, I mean, his point essentially was, you know, he was taken aback by the extent to which it was taken up, what he did. I mean, the most famous case is, I think, is Benjamin Britten and the War Requiem. I mean, when the War Requiem, the double LP, as it was originally, of the War Requiem, was produced less than a year after the world premiere in Coventry in May 1962. I know, I was there, and suddenly, you know, this double LP sells 400,000 copies in the first 3 months. I mean, Britten couldn't believe it. He simply couldn't believe it. You know, that this is a big classical series piece of music about war and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly, and in a way, he never, ever reconciled himself to the fact that virtually overnight, he'd gone from being a very famous composer, probably one of the greatest composers of the 20th century, to public property. That's what it amounted to. And I don't think Britten ever really understood that or reconciled himself to that. But that is what happens. We know that is what happens or has happened to, you know, going back to Ted Hughes and Birthday and now Leonard having Leonard died, Cohen. You know.
Tell me, what do you think it was that drew Marty Machat to you? I mean, why did he pick you for the project?
Well, I think there were two reasons. One, I'd actually met Leonard at the Isle of Wight Festival. And I'd met him because I knew Marty Machat. And I knew Marty Machat because when I did my second ever film, a film for the BBC called All My Loving, then I wanted to interview Frank Zappa. And I figured out who Frank Zappa's manager was, and he was Marty Machat. And so I met Marty, who was a wonderful man. I adored him. His idea of a fun evening was to go around Greenwich Village from one cookie shop to another cookie shop. So you finished up being tanked up to here with cookies. And that I realized the first time I met him, I was being auditioned as we went around the cookie shop to check that, you know, I really was relatively serious and relatively coherent before we finished up in a basement and there was Frank Zappa. So Marty had been my as it were, almost my conduit with another guy, a wonderful man called Herb Cohen, who was actually Frank Zappa's manager. So therefore I'd met Marty in relation first to Frank Zappa. And then I interviewed Frank for All My Loving, and then I interviewed Frank several times again for odd things that I was doing, because I then worked at the BBC. So, you know, the relationship grew. And then I did, without question, the worst film ever in the entire history of the universe, called 200 Motels.
Some would argue with you.
I know. Well, I mean, it's not comparable with any of the great artists that we've been talking about. But, I mean, I know it has this huge cult following. And, I mean, I'm dragged along to introduce it extremely reluctantly. I sometimes agree. And my opening line is, listen, this is the worst film ever made in the entire history of the universe. Haven't you got anything better to do than go away? And then I beat a hasty retreat. So, I mean, everything had sort of, you know, interlinked. I mean, Marty certainly knew who I was, and I knew who Marty was. And so I didn't, the invitation was not to somebody he didn't know. And he knew that I'd made some quite interesting films, but also some terrible films. He thought exactly the kind of person that Leonard would like.
Did you, you said that you were reading Leonard's poetry at this time, and,
yes.
And I guess his novels. Were you aware of his music? Were you listening to that as a fan? Or
not originally, no, absolutely not originally. I mean, you couldn't, after I saw him at the Isle of Wight, I then thought, God, this guy sings as well, I'd better go and listen. So yes, I mean, I think at that point there were only three LPs by the time I went. And obviously I knew, I'd done my homework and I knew them backwards. I didn't think they were, I thought they were interesting songs because of the poetry. I didn't think he sang them particularly well. He sounded as if he'd been dragged into the recording studio reluctantly, going back to that woman in Toronto. I mean, she'd got it right. So I wasn't anticipating great musical performances, which is what took me aback when we started to film. I mean, I think there were 22 concerts altogether. And I said, listen, I'm not going to film every single concert. You know, we'd go around the twist. So we agreed that we would do every fifth concert, I think it was.
It was just a random decision like that. It wasn't like we're going to do Berlin and cities.
No, there was a plan. It was every fifth concert. So as he put it, oh, good, I've got four concerts in which I can try to get it right. try to remember the words. Also, he was playing with a new group of musicians. He hadn't really played with these guys before. They were all phenomenally gifted musicians and two wonderful singers, both of one of whom especially went off and had a great solo career.
Jennifer
Warnes, yeah. Yes. But the others were absolutely superb musicians. And of course, what I realised quite early on, I mean, the first concerts were in Dublin, and I realised that he couldn't be relied on to sing either the same words or to sing in the same key or to remember what happened in the songs. I mean, it wasn't completely improvised, but he wanted to be free to change the songs as he went along. And I thought what was astonishing about all his band was that, just like, you know, the Bob Dylan, the band, you know, they were onto it like a flash. And so wherever he went, they went with him.
I think there might be several moments in the film, but one comes to mind straight away where he starts singing like a mock version of a Leonard Cohen song. He starts singing either about the speaker being broken or another one, something else, but he's mocking himself.
Yeah.
But in the middle of that mock song, the backup singers start coming in and backing him up, as if it's a real song rather than an impromptu.
Absolutely. Well, the two girls, I mean, they were astonishing. Whatever he did, he went straight with them. And also, there's a throwaway remark that some journalist asks him, oh, and you've got Bob Johnson on keyboard. Wasn't he Bob Dylan's early producer? Yes. I didn't know he was a keyboard. Well, I don't think he knows either. It's just wonderful. And in fact, we were always, I mean, very quietly, Leonard said to me one day, he said, you know, if there's any way to keep Bob's contribution down to a minimum and, you know, pull the microphone down, I'd appreciate it. But in fact, Bob wasn't as bad as that. And I think he only knew two chords. And luckily, Leonard sang more or less in one key all the time. So occasionally you hear a little squeak off the portable organ that Bob adds, and it works.
It does yeah. work.
And
actually.
I mean, if Bob Dylan was prepared to accept him as a producer, I mean, he weren't no fool. And as you see in the film, I mean, frequently Bob was the person who held it all together in terms of trying to calm things down when things did get a bit shirty from time to time. Inevitably, I mean, that's rock and roll. But the great thing was that because Leonard had no record deal, there was nobody there. There was only the crew. The very small sound crew, I mean, his backing crew, him, very small sound crew, which is why things kept going wrong. They were under-resourced, we would say now. Marty, who was always there, and my film crew, which was two people plus me. Well, two and a half people plus me. There was a guy in the sound crew who wanted to help, so we let him help. So it was a tiny little unit, but, you know, that kind of film would be impossible today with Leonard or anybody, because, you know, you'd have 16 PR people on your shoulder all the time, 15 record executives, and so on and so on. And none of that happened.
Rear. Leonard Cohen is going to sing his song of anguish and despair. Here he comes, folks. The organ. organ is playing. The skulls appear, they're lowered by wires from a man above the stage. They stand there, the broken down nightingale. Ah, the broken down nightingale is gonna sing you a little song.
How did Cohen feel about being filmed? Was there any kind of a restriction to the access?
No, that was part of the deal originally. When this meeting in the office in New York, when he told me, I don't want to make the film, but I'm clutching energy of Slate. He gave a list of what were in effect conditions. As I said, you know, I don't want a tour film. I don't want to be presented as a composer of silly little love songs. You know, I want it my political concerns with a small p, very clear. I said, fine, all right, I've got a couple of conditions to my accepting the film. First one was a really technical thing. I said, you know, the problem is we're going to have to film with celluloid. That's digital cameras. Digital technology didn't exist. So celluloid cameras, and it's 16mm film, and the exposure is very, very slow. And so to get any kind of reading, especially in a concert, I just said concert, you know, there's going to have to be rather more light than you expect. To which he immediately said, well, can I wear my dark glasses? I said, occasionally, I said. But in fact, that worked out quite well, because I only had one light. I had one camera and I had one light. And we always put the light beyond him. So it was never shining in his eyes. And he noticed that, of course, quick as a flash, and he thanked me for that and said that was very compromised. But the big condition was, and it really was, I don't know what I would have said had he refused, but he didn't. I said, Leonard, we're going to be together for a month. You know, my lot, there's only three of me and you lot. Please never, ever shut the door. Whatever happens, I'm going to be there and filming it. Whatever happens. Little did we know about, you know, the equipment breaking down and all the other things that you see in the film, and him weeping at the end. That was the condition, and he absolutely stuck with it. And it was quite funny. The only thing that went wrong, there was the sauna bath. And he said, you've got to get in the sauna bath. So we all stripped off and got in the sauna. Of course, I mean, the camera clouded up and we didn't say a thing. And when we came out, there's some very pretty girls there. And when we came out, he said, did you get all that? Did you get all that? Another sequence in the film. But of course, we all fell around laughing. I said, he knew perfectly well we couldn't film what was going on.
At least we have the shower sequence.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the swimming sequence.
Yeah, which, absolutely. Okay. No, I mean, he never shut the door. Which is why over the period of time we got access. So, I mean, the where you see him crying at the end, which was in Jerusalem the last night, really was the last night. I mean, the camera was as close to him as I am to you. So, I mean, not much more than 3 or 4 feet. And he didn't take a blind bit of notice. And in fact, at one point, the cameraman turned around and whispered to me. He said, should I stop? I said, no, if Leonard wants you to stop, he'll tell you. But he didn't take any notice of us. And I think that wasn't simply that he wanted that on screen. It was completely unselfconscious in that sense. And nor was it necessarily in his mind that he'd promised that he would never close the door. But it was simply that, you know, that's what happened. And we were there and we were part of the family. He thought of us as part of the family.
It helps with the access.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, I guess he was true to his word. If he made a deal, he made a deal. Maybe he was an honest guy.
Yeah, oh, he was. I mean, if I was asked to sum him up then and now, and well, I've just written about it, but now he sadly died. He was a man of utter, utter straightforwardness, truthfulness, and integrity. He was the kind of person of whom you could say, as was said of Amundsen, the first man who went to the South Pole, you know, the notion of telling a lie would be beyond him. You know, he wouldn't even understand the concept. That's not to say that he wasn't occasionally diplomatic or discreet. That's not the same thing. No, never dubious. No, never dubious.
No, not dubious. I said mischievous.
Oh, mischievous. Oh, that, certainly. But, you know, that you recognised. But a man of absolute, utter... I mean, of course, that's what the poems are about. That's what the music making is about. There's nothing to hide. This is me, this is what I am, and this is what I stand for. And, you know, I'm delighted that you like my work, but, you know, I respect you if you don't like my work. These are generalities, but, I mean, I think that would have been my summary of him. And that's why he's greatly mourned. He communicated something which was important to him, but he managed to communicate it, like all very great artists, in a way that made it universally important or significant or relevant. You know, he speaks to us collectively and as individuals. That's what all great art does.
And maybe he's saying something that people aspire to but are not quite able to achieve.
Well, he's tapping into all of our anxieties and fears about loneliness and unhappiness and the inadequacy of making contact with other people, the difficulties about making contact with other people, and the sadness of the human predicament. I mean, I think it's no accident that he wrote when Marianne, the real Marianne, died. She was dying, and he wrote to her in the hospital saying, "I'm really, really sorry. I'll be joining you soon." Now, nobody knew at that time, he knew, but he certainly wasn't telling anybody, that he had already had been diagnosed with cancer, which finally killed him. But it's the poignancy of the message, as it were, "I'll be joining you soon." That's a man of absolute laser beam honesty, truthfulness about his condition, about our condition, and he's able to convey that in simple music with simple words. But like all great artists, we all think, well, to be or not to be, four words. God, why didn't we think that? Well, we're not Shakespeare. Shakespeare thought it. And so on. You can find 100 instances of that amongst great art. Something of utter simplicity, utter truthfulness, and has universal resonance. And that's what Leonard did in his great poems and great songs. They're not all great, and they're not all good. But the ones that are, boy. And the same is true of Dylan, of course. I mean, that's why they were pieced together.
When you started the film, did you have an idea of the kind of film that you wanted to make? So you were just going to follow, because Leonard, he specified what his wishes were, and you were there just to capture whatever.
The only wish he made, as I said, was, don't make me out to be a writer of silly little love songs, sentimental love songs. Don't make a tour film. Don't fail to notice the political, with a small p, aspect of my work. But of course, quite early on, he realized, as when we were working together, that I understood all of those things very clearly. And that was part of my responsibility as a filmmaker. But the structure of the film and all of that, I wouldn't have predicted it, because I didn't know what was going to happen.
Had you seen the Bob Dylan film at that time?
Don't
Look Back?
Yes. Yes.
Was that something that impressed you, or that?
Well, I did. It's Pennebaker, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Because I'd got to know Pennebaker quite well when I then did a series much later on. After I'd done my Leonard Cohen film, I got to know Pennebaker quite well when I did a big series, All You Need Is Love. And so we often talked about his experiences with Dylan, my experiences. But no, it didn't influence me in any way. But I mean, I'd seen it and thought, how clever. But don't forget, at that time, those over-the-shoulder films, fly on the wall films, were virtually unknown. People didn't do it. And they didn't do it principally because the equipment was very cumbersome. That was why. And Pennebaker, I remember, talked to him about it. And, they had hell awful job time to time. Dylan wouldn't allow lights to be put up. So, it was really hit and miss. But of course, Dylan being Dylan, it's fascinating. And he's a fascinating, extraordinary man.
Yeah, even him being silent or refusing to be interviewed is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is.
What did you think of the relationship that Cohen had with his band? What was the dynamic there?
I mean, short of being in bed together, and I suspect one or two of them probably were. The only comparable experience I can relate is Bob Dylan with the band. I mean, his group called the Robbie Robertson and all that lot. I mean, they musically speaking, they thought as one person. That was what was extraordinary about them. And with Leonard's band, I mean, I don't think they'd ever played together before they met to rehearse for that tour. They did meet to rehearse for the tour. But I think that was the first time he knew them as individuals, but I don't think they'd ever played together. But of course, they quickly realized, and they must have realized even during the rehearsal period, which I was not present at, that he was the ultimate improviser, just like Dylan. Changed the order of the verses, and we had a terrible trouble when we started to piece the film together in 40 years later. God, 40 years later. That we didn't have any complete version of any song on the bits and pieces that I managed to find, which were upstairs. So, for example, in Suzanne, the first complete song that you hear, I mean, the first song you hear is Avalanche, but the first song you see him performing complete, three verses, each verse comes from a different place, different concert. I think the middle verse was in a completely different key. So we were adjusting the keys to try and, you know, make it sound as if it's one performance.
It's noticeable during the film, but it actually enhanced my experience of the film because it gave me a feeling of time passing and of travel.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yes,
it's the
I
same
do.
Song,
no, I do.
But you actually get more out of it than just the performance.
Yes, absolutely. It's not a performance film.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things that he originally wanted. But just in terms of, I only mentioned the Suzanne song by way of illustration, that, you know, he would change it each night. And because musically, as I said, musically speaking, the band thought as one person and the two girls, that wherever he went there, they were with him. It wasn't like Cream. The point about Cream was that on any given number, two of them were trying to play the other one right off the stage, or one of them was trying to play the other two right off the stage. And that's what gave their concerts, their live concerts, such an extraordinary dynamism. Because, I mean, Ginger would frequently change the beat to see if they were aware. I mean, it used to drive Eric absolutely crazy. I mean, Eric was the one who suffered. And Jack Bruce would suddenly, invert, literally invert, play backwards or upside down the bass line, just to see if they noticed. Of course they noticed, but of course they were such phenomenally gifted musicians that they were onto it like a flash. But I mean, that was musical rivalry, which both sparked and spurred them on and was extraordinary to listen to. That's an extreme case of what was happening with Leonard. But I mean, Leonard would frequently change the verse, shorten the verse, change the key. And so, you know, they had to be on the money.
But the dynamic was different. They were supportive.
Well, they weren't quite. Yeah, they were. Yeah, the dynamic, as you said, they were supportive in that they were playing supportive roles. But I mean, he would feed off them. And he loved the performance of That's No Way to Say Goodbye, or is it Suzanne, or is it Marianne at the end of the film? One of the two songs which he sings on the stage in Jerusalem, I can't remember now, Peter, the bass player, was inventing a whole new bass line, which certainly doesn't exist on any recording, where he's kind of scooping up and down and scooping down and doing sort of amazing stuff. And Leonard was responding to that. I mean, he was a very extraordinary musician. He would deny that, but he was an extraordinary musician. His ear was very acute, and he was responding to what particularly the bass player was doing, and the girls.
It's clear that he can improvise. It's clear that he can come up with stuff on the spot, not just lyrics, but also with music.
I mean,
it's very similar to his usual style, but he's still coming up with something.
Absolutely.
On the spot. How would you describe his relationship to the audience?
I've never, ever, I think, come across any solo artist who had such a rapport with the audience in that he could sense their mood immediately. That was partly because they were all fans, even the ones who thought they'd been financially ripped off because the sound equipment wasn't working. That was in Denmark, by the way. I've read that it was in Germany.
Because the guys sound German. Hmm? The guys that are complaining, they sound very German.
No, that was definitely in Copenhagen, I remember it. Anyway, they even on those occasions, so the people who'd come, as Marty Machat says at one point, you know, they knew the words of all the songs. And when he threatened to cancel one concert, which, because he got fed up with the sound equipment not working, partly a kind of pose on his part, but nonetheless, you could feel his exasperation. He said, "I'm cancelling it." And Marty says, "I went out to the audience," and the audience said, "You know, just tell him to come back. We'll sing the songs. He can just be there." And I think there was an element of that, certainly. And there's all the jokes that go along, where he plays two chords and they all clap. And then he says, "You can't possibly know what I was going to play. I only know those two chords." Again, not quite true, but you saw the audience. And he never made a big thing about the chit-chat. You know, I mean, in a way, he's a bit. I mean, Dylan never says anything to anybody and usually turns his back on the audience. Leonard would never quite do that. But I've not come here to tell funny stories. I've come here to, you know, but I'll respond if you shout something out. And, you know, the wonderful story he tells about, you know, the copyright of Suzanne being signed away with a piece of paper. You know, that's going to make you want to love him. And the audience arrived knowing the music, knowing the songs, loving him already. So he had a ready-made, he wasn't going to have to, you know, rescue, he's not a stand-up comedian who's going to have to persuade the audience that, you know, he is really a great performer. There's already this extraordinary empathy going along. But even so, he knew instinctively, I think, he felt at one with them. And, you know, he wanted them to clap, as he says in the film. Oh, well, go ahead, clap then if you insist.
You get the feeling that he's trying to develop some kind, almost like a communion with the audience.
Yeah, it was. Well, no, absolutely.
And that it's like a spiritual experience for him. And I got the feeling that you were trying to portray a certain spiritual and religious element, both with the audience but also with the band backstage.
That's a very good point, and it's a very good question indeed, which is almost impossible to answer, as I'm sure you realise. Religious, no. Sense of community, yes. Sense of what is the point of me standing on stage singing my songs, poems? Well, you know, I need to feel that you're with me in going through this experience that I had of writing this particular song. I'm not going to just sing it, wave goodbye. You know, I want you to be with me on that experience. And he says again, at some point, to one of the journalists who interviewed him, that doesn't happen every night. It's not just, you know, the Kabbalah and, you know, God and all that stuff. He wasn't at all religious. And there's very funny remarks about, you know, do you go to the synagogue? Depends how good the singing is. given that it's we're in Israel and he's being asked clearly a pointedly religious question, do you practice? By that it means, you know, are you a practicing Jew? And to which, of course, Leonard replies, I practice all the time. If you see what I mean.
Yes, but that was a joke.
It's not a kind of put-down joke. It's not a joke at the journalist's expense, but it's one of those remarks. So there was a communal feel on the best nights. I mean, 22 nights, it didn't happen every night, but it certainly did happen, of which Jerusalem is the obvious example. But there was a sense of a communal experience of what it was that he had achieved. So when he's singing Chelsea Hotel, and again he's changing the words and talking about what had happened to him, I'd never want to speak for Leonard now, of course I certainly can't speak for Leonard, but my feeling always was, this is what happened to me in bed with this girl in that town, New York, as it happens, in that hotel on that night. You, the audience, have all been through something similar. So what we are doing here is remembering collectively what I have put into song. So this is not, I am telling you about my experiences, but no, I'm trying to be with you and understanding all the things that you've gone through. And I think that was a very powerful emotion. And I think one of the greatest songs he ever wrote, I think, at that time, but I still think, is Who By Fire. And Who By Fire is absolutely, you know, this is what happens to us if we go down that particular route of trying to find salvation through drugs, through all the other religious teachings. You know, it's a devastating song. But again, it's not being told in your face. This is something that I have gone through and I have survived. And I believe, says Leonard, sounds as if I'm speaking for him, but again, I repeat, I clearly can't. I believe that most of you, if not all of you, but certainly most of you, have experienced something similar in your journey through life. And we should come together to talk about this. It is very much, we should come together to talk about this. This is why the great concerts were, and continue to be, long after the film, continue to be a communal experience rather than singer, song, audience.
Like a product consumed, it's much more of an experience rather than a consumption.
It's a communal experience. I'm like all great art, I'm inviting you to go through what I went through. And that's true of all great art. I mean, that's it. That he had in common. That was why he was a great artist as opposed to just a singer of songs. Now, he, I think, would be the last person ever to agree with that or enunciate that or articulate that. But I think that's, in the end, why and sadly it is at an end now, that's why, I mean, the 84 verses of Hallelujah, which I think is one of the dreariest songs ever written. I'm delighted that it was such a huge commercial success for him. But if you read the 84 verses, I mean, you can find them somewhere. You know, this is him trying to articulate this same thing. You know, I did this, hallelujah. I did that, hallelujah. You know, we've all done this, hallelujah. We've all done that, hallelujah. It's again, it's a communal experience. He is standing there on behalf of us, but not to the exclusion of us, but hopefully the inclusion of us.
The killers that run the other countries are trying to get us to overthrow the killers that run our own. I, for one, prefer the rule of our native killers. I am convinced the foreign killer will kill more of us than the old familiar killer does. Frankly, I don't believe anyone out there really wants us to solve our social problems. I base this all on how I feel about the man next door. I just hope he doesn't get any uglier. Therefore, I am a patriot. I don't like to see a burning flag because it excites the killers on either side to unfortunate excess, which goes on gaily, quite unchecked, until everyone is dead.
You said that Leonard wanted a film that was political with a small p.
Yeah.
And, you know, I found the film quite political, actually, and completely unusually so for a tour film or a concert film. And there's a very strong anti-establishment message in there, anti-authoritarian message. There's a lot of talk about money versus art, that whole debate. I'm sort of wondering whether this is something that you wanted to insert or whether this was just a reflection of what was happening at the time.
Well, I mean, I approach all my films, however inadequate they are, with a completely open mind. I don't have an agenda. I don't arrive with a script. If I interview someone, I certainly don't stand there with a clipboard, if you see what I mean. I always have one. No, I always have one general question and then go where the flow takes us, and usually into completely unpredictable and unexpected areas. Just the same as me and the camera. You know, I never know quite. I'm talking about the documentaries, not about the feature films. But the documentaries, you know, the making of any documentary, but particularly the kind of films I do, is for me a journey of exploration. You know, I start from one place and I see where it takes me, and I've no idea where it might take me. And so I didn't impose anything into the film. I just am watching and listening very carefully to what he's saying and getting a sense of him and trying to find a way to portray that in film. And, of course, that occasionally does land one in difficulties, because then they'll look at it and say, but that's not me. And that isn't what happened in this particular case. But, I mean, I have experienced that. And you have to be ready for that if... I mean, I remember I made a big film once about Peter Sellers. Sellers, the actor. And that was, I mean, Peter sat and, I'll never forget it, I mean, it was terrifying. He sat there and absolutely wept for the practically the entire film, because he's seeing himself on screen. Him. This is really him. And Spike, as Milligan, was telling it like it is, you know. And Peter looked at me at the end, I'll never ever forget, I mean, and crying, and he'd stopped crying, but there was tears in his eyes, and says, do you really think that's me? And I said, Peter, I think that is you. And he said, I don't like it. And I said, well, I can understand why you don't like it, but, you know, allow me to say, I think this makes you even more extraordinary than you are already. This isn't funny Jewish lad from North London doing funny voices. This is someone with real problems. And he said, you're right. So he left it. I mean, he didn't, not that he could have done, but he did not have the right to change it. Now, I've only ever had one really, really bad experience, which was with Vangelis. and that film.
That's a recent film. That's
well, yes,
ago.
But I mean, I've disowned the film completely. I mean, the contract with Vangelis is absolutely clear. He had no editorial rights in the film whatsoever, except that if he did a live performance in the course of making the film, and he wasn't happy with his performance, then he could redo it. Fair enough. I mean, I understood that, but nothing else. And he's done his very best to block the film at every inch of the way.
So obviously he didn't want the film out. That kind of takes us to the release of The Bird on the Wire.
Well, no, Bird on the Wire was more complicated. And it wasn't the same issue at all. I edit my own films. The film, I edited it very quickly, as I always do, and about a month after the tour was finished. I knew Leonard was coming to London, and I showed it to him, and we sat there together. I did a slightly sneaky thing, and because I was under some pressure from Marty, the manager, we'd shown it to the BBC, BBC Omnibus, who bought it. We'll have it anyway. I said, it's a rough cut, I'm finished. Don't care, we can see what it's going to be. Yes, we'll take it. And they would have got their money back virtually in one go. Because Leonard didn't really want to make the film, but Marty, the manager, was desperate to get something if his artist wasn't going to appear and no record contract. That's why Marty really wanted the film. Marty had paid for the film so that Leonard felt under no pressure whatsoever. Leonard comes to see the film, and I don't think he either disliked it or liked it. He just sort of sat there and, you know, seeing himself on screen is different from what you think you'll look like on screen. It's simple as that. He admired the fact that I'd got these great performances. He liked all of that. He liked all the chit-chat backstage and so on. He wasn't sure whether, you know, him with his bit of paper, which had LSD on, of course, whether that was acceptable.
I wanted to actually ask you, just let me interrupt you, because at the end, that Jerusalem concert,
yeah,
it goes quite wrong, and he walks off stage, yeah, and then he needs to be kind of brought back, yeah, on stage, and there's a lot of talk. Was he just having a bad trip?
No.
It wasn't LSD taking hold of him.
No, he felt, as I told you earlier, that, you know, it wasn't happening. Jerusalem for him was terribly important. It wasn't just that it was going to be the last concert, but it's Jerusalem, for God's sake. He wanted that sense of community, which had worked several times, strange places it worked. It worked in London, oddly enough, at the Albert Hall. He wanted that for Jerusalem. It had happened in Tel Aviv, in spite of the riot, but it hadn't happened in Jerusalem, and he was very, very upset about it. I don't think it had anything to do with being high, nothing at all. So his view of it always, of the film which he saw, always was that it was a bit confrontational. That was the word he always used. He felt the film was confrontational, in your face, basically, because we'd started with, as in fact the finished film now does start, with the riot. And he said to me, I remember we talked about it, he said, don't you think we should start with Bird on the Wire? Because that's what the film's about. I said, no, that's the point of the film. You know, I've tried in my way to be free, like a bird on a wire, blah, blah, blah. But he thought that starting, he didn't not want to include the riot that happened in Tel Aviv, but he thought it was a mistake, you know, in your face. And Avalanche is quite an aggressive song. Aggressive in the sense that it's, again, hammering home, you know, his feeling of inadequacy, his feeling of what's the point of all of this. So he thought it's confrontational. And I then did something which, I only did it because I liked him enormously, I admired him enormously, and I don't know why I did it. I said, Leonard, here's all the material, you know, if you want to tinker with this and tinker with that, go take the print away, have a look, and, you know, we'll organise a cutting room for you, and then if you can, you know, see some way to get rid of this element which you're unhappy about, we'll do it. And it was perfectly friendly. I mean, it was absolutely perfectly friendly. Don't forget, Marty paid for the film. And I think, I mean, the value of the money, of course, is irrelevant now. But the figures are quite interesting, that it was approximately $30,000 we'd spent until that point. And I thought, I'll see him in a month's time. He'll come back and say, you know, can we change that? And could we? And then we could discuss it. And there was no hostility at all. 2 years later, and now $270,000 of his own money, because Marty told me, I refused to pay for it. I told Leonard, you're making a terrible mistake, leave it. Because Marty knew that the BBC was wanting to buy it. And then, of course, when the BBC saw version two, they didn't want it.
What were the differences between the two versions?
Well, I mean, I didn't oversee it until, you know, the great rediscovery in about 2008 or 2009. So I never quite knew. There was a one night show, I think, at the Rainbow Cinema, as it then was called, on Seven Sisters. And I'd been sent, in the intervening 30-some-odd years, I'd been sent bootleg copies. And obviously it must have been on German television, because all the bootleg copies have German subtitles. And, I mean, the picture was terrible. I mean, it was just like this all the time. And the sound, you know, hello? And so I didn't really watch it very carefully. And I never criticise anybody else's films, not in that sense. But I mean, I could see why, when I looked at it finally in the great rediscovery process, I just thought it was a mess. I mean, it was a mess. I mean, the basic material was there, but you couldn't follow where you were or why you were there or what was happening or what was happening to whom or what the point of putting this song in here was. And the songs were used in that version of the film, but they'd not been, I don't know where they found the various takes from, obviously filmed by me, but if I may say so, not filmed terribly well. So it was just a mess. And of course we know now that Leonard hated it, wouldn't promote it, wouldn't have anything to do with it, and also he spent $278,000 of his own money. That wasn't the cause of his financial downfall, but boy, that kind of helped. And it stung. I mean, there's no doubt it stung. And I saw Leonard pretty frequently after that for quite some years. And always the conversation was, where's the film? And I'd look at Leonard and say, why are you asking me where's the film? If you don't know, I don't know. I think he did know. It was an embarrassment, and it was put in a warehouse where it was eventually discovered, oddly enough, by Herb Cohen, the other one of the original triumvirate, the Frank Zappa manager. But I remember one time I went to see him backstage. Again, couldn't have been more affable and friendly and saying, you're surviving. Yes, I'm surviving. I'm surviving too. That was always the word he liked. But one time he said, I've got a present for you. And he went away and he came back. And he had another copy of The Energy of Slaves, because that's how I'd originally met. And I thought, well, thank you, Leonard, very much. I think I made a joke of it. So I hope you've signed it. Yes, I've signed it. I'll look at it later. Don't worry about it. But he'd written a whole new poem on the leaf, in fly leaf. So I have upstairs, I have a copy of The Energy of Slaves with an additional poem by Leonard Cohen signed by him.
It's an unpublished poem.
I think it has now been published, but then absolutely not. He'd written just a completely new poem. So there was no hard feelings. It never got to the point of hard feelings at all. And then, in fact, when it became known, well, when we rediscovered the film and I slowly, from these endless fragments, started to put it back together again, which took much longer than the original film. I mean, it really did. Boy, I mean, I was being driven to distraction by it. But I was determined to do it. I was absolutely determined to do it. And when we finished it, we sent it to him.
Let me ask you, why were you so determined to
do it? Well, I just instinctively knew that this was a great singer, a very, very good poet, and an amazing performer. And I felt, you know, this film, which had been made, as I said, at the height of his powers in terms of his vocalising with some of his most famous songs, you know, I thought in a strange kind of way, I owed it to him. You know, it wasn't for my benefit I was doing this. I thought it was for his benefit. So we finished the film, we sent it to him. Back came a message fairly quickly, actually. It said, "Dear Tony, I'm so glad the problem has been resolved." He loved that idea because, you know, it obviously worried him all these years, you know, that he'd fucked it up, and that I would probably hate him as a result. I didn't hate him. I only hated the fact that the film had disappeared because it was celluloid, and once you start cutting celluloid, difficult to put it back together again. It's not like digital tape, you know, you can do that and you do anything with it, but not then.
Now that he's passed away, what do you think his total contribution has been?
Well, I think, like all great artists, he told us something about our world and about our condition and predicament as human beings. And he told it eloquently in utterly memorable melodies, with utterly memorable words. I think one of the reasons the words are utterly memorable, he has in common with all great poets, is, I mean, like T.S. Eliot, you know, or Yeats even. Yeah, he was a great admirer of Yeats. It's not that the poetry speaks in metaphor. It is metaphor. It is mystical. It is therefore mysterious, but it's spoken in words of one syllable. I mean, the beginning of four quartets, in my end is my beginning. Sorry? In my end is my beginning. These are familiar words. We all know what those words mean. But my God, what does that sentence mean? In my end is my beginning. And Leonard, in exactly the same way, has, think of Who by Fire, has tapped into very complex, very profound philosophical statements which are articulated in words of one syllable. Who by fire? What does it mean? Listen to the song. We still don't know what it means. But the importance of it is that what it means to me is different from what it means to you, is different from what it means to every single person who ever hears that song, reads those words. It has a universal resonance. But, I mean, that's the essence of great art. That is what great art does. Again, quoting E.M. Forster, it communicates long before it's understood. You know, you get to be or not to be. Oh, fine, I know, that's four words, to be or not. Yeah, why didn't we think of that? Oh, well, you know, what does it mean? And so you're on then to, you're into an endlessly evolving universe of meaning. And I think that's the great thing about Leonard's songs, you know, that on one level they're perfectly straightforward. That's no way to say goodbye. My God, the number of times I've said that to women that I've adored. And, you know, we've had a row. And so I write to them saying, that's no way to say goodbye, if you say, or words that effect. Well, you know, I'm to my eternal misery and loss, I'm not Leonard Cohen. But he managed to say that. So every broken dream, every broken romance, which, of course, we all endure, and we all suffer from, and we all somehow survive from, but we all experience, Leonard has put his finger on it.
Universal truths.
The resonance of universal truths, which are, I mean, it sounds like I'm suddenly being an evolutionist, but I mean, you know, it's an expanding universe, and you never get to the bottom of it, nor should you. Essence of great poetry again, you know, the end is my beginning, we could argue about that for the next year. We wouldn't ever get any closer to it.
But it might be fun.
Well, it would be fascinating, and I mean, Mozart is the same, you know. I made a film about Mozart with a great Mozart pianist called Michiko Ushida. And she says in the course of the film, it's like holding sand in your hand and it's going through. You can't stop it. You can't ever, ever get close to Mozart. You know, because as you get closer, he's disappearing. You know, his greatness as a composer is not in question. The greatness of what he wrote is not in question. The greatness, but what do we mean by this? We don't know. Where does it come from? Or how does it arrive in our universe? The fact is, it's there. Now, I'm not comparing Leonard with Mozart at all, but with great, great songwriters. Schubert is the same. The Winterreise, all the songs in Winterreise, you don't ever get close to them. Even the greatest interpreters, like Fischer-Dieskau, would tell you, I never, ever understood this music. And yet, he gave the greatest of all performances, I think, that exist on record, of the Schubert's last great song cycle, Winterreise. You know, which are so simple. I can play them, and I'm a terrible pianist. But, you know, great art has that quality. It's instantly accessible, but it's instantly and forever and permanently beyond our understanding. To be or not to be, instantly accessible. But my God, what does it mean?
You've made, I think, over 100 films.
I think it's 121.
And so whereabouts does Bird on a Wire fit? On a personal level, where does that fit on your experience scale?
Well, I understand the reason for the question, but it's a very hard question to answer.
I'm not saying pick one thing or another.
No, no, I appreciate that. Leonard has just died, and obviously, you know, because the film is presently being run.
Sometimes you make things and you're very happy with them.
Oh, I see.
And you remember them, you look at them 20 years later and you are absolutely thrilled with them. Sometimes you make things and 20 years later you think, I don't know what I was doing or I don't agree with this at all.
Well, there are some films which continue to resonate with me for various reasons. Now, it's an unfair question. Leonard's just died, so obviously it's in the forefront of my mind. And also, I went through the trauma of having to piece it back together again. So it became very, very important for me in that sense. You know, this is something which was lost and is now found. And don't need to tell you the story of the prodigal son, but you know, that obviously has significance. Is it among the 10 films I would take to a desert island? Well, I wouldn't take any of my films to start with. I can tell you the films I would take, but I wouldn't want to include that, but then I wouldn't want to include any of my films. It's not that I'm embarrassed about them. You know, some of the films I think are okay and some less so. And I suppose in that context, Bird Noir would be included in the ones that are not quite as bad as I feared at the time.
And on a more personal level, what do you think was the main thing that you took away from knowing Leonard Cohen?
That it's possible to be humble and great. And I mean, without question, the only person that has frightened me, not because I knew who he was or I knew what he had achieved, but who had that very same quality, was Benjamin Britten, who I knew personally very, very well. And I thought, you know, if you came into the room, you automatically stood up because you just knew you were in the presence of greatness, would last for as long as civilization lasts. His work would last as long as civilization lasts. But he was a child. He was ridiculously humble. So to be humble and yet have about you something which is everlasting, greatness of art, that's a very special quality. And boy, you don't see it very often. I mean, I've seen it in other people. They have in common a complete lack of awareness of how great they are. I mean, great is a totally inadequate word, but, you know, what the thing that they achieve. I didn't know Shostakovich very well, but I know Mrs. Shostakovich. She would say exactly the same about Shostakovich. He had absolutely no idea that he was probably one of the greatest composers of the 20th century. Not probably, certainly was one of the greatest composers of the 20th century.
Maybe it's a quality that you need in order to be... Maybe it allows you to have a certain focus which makes your work better.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think you get to the point... I mean, I'm not one of those people, so I can't really imagine it, but I can conceive of the fact that you get to the point where the work is all that matters, and I'm not interested in my public persona, and I deeply resent being thought of as public property. Richard Burton, in a strange kind of way, I was talking about Richard Burton earlier. Richard Burton was exactly the same. I mean, I remember one day he was being made up, and we put the camera on him, on his reflection in the mirror. And he suddenly started to say, he said, I really don't understand why people think I am this big star. You know, my nose is wonky, my eyes are not quite right, I've got pock marks here. You know, my hair is a mess. That's because I'm wearing too many wigs, but my hair is a mess. And I have this voice that people say is so extra. I can't hear my voice. Can you hear my voice? And he just tears himself to bits. But it's not self-destructive. It's just... or inadequacy, or insecurity, it is all of those things. It is deep humility, which, both in his case and all the other cases I've cited, seems to be an adjunct of the people who are on a different level from the rest of us. That's what it amounts to. I remember when I made a big film about Stravinsky, we went to interview Nadia Boulanger, who had been his teacher. He'd already written, you know, three of the biggest hits of the 20th century, and yet he turns up in Paris and goes for lessons from Nadia Boulanger. And I said, what did he get out of it? And she said, I've no idea. And I said, well, what did you get out of it? And she said, it was a tiny little French woman, she said, you know, people come with a vision, and all we can do is follow them and hope that we will learn something on the way. And Jack Charlton, interestingly enough, when I made a film about Bobby Moore, we interviewed all the surviving members of the team, it's everybody except Bobby Moore, and he stopped almost in mid-story. I mean, we were interviewing him in Newcastle, and he looked out of the window, and he turned slowly back towards the camera, and he said, you know, the thing about Bobby is, he was one of us, part of the team, one of us, but he wasn't like us. And I thought, that's the perfect description of genius. One of us, he did what we do, but he wasn't like us. Same was true of Leonard. You just knew. You knew there was something different about him.
Thank you for downloading this episode of DocPod. For more information about Bird on a Wire and other documentary films, please visit us at thedocpod.net. We'll leave you now with the sounds of Leonard and his band, backstage, having some wine and bread.
Still
in the glory land, there outshines the sun. I got a home.